Our next speaker is Christian List from the London School of Economics, where he's philosophy. And Karen is going to remain the discussant.
Okay, so the assignment that I've been given is to discuss a collective wisdom from the perspective of the theory of judgment aggregation. And for this reason, my paper draws on some previous work that I've done in this area, including some collaborative work with Philip Pettit, which I hereby acknowledge. And I also want to record my debt to my colleague Franz Dietrich, with whom I've been doing quite a lot of technical work in this area. And later on, I'll report on one particular theorem that we have done in joint work. So here's the outline of my talk for today. I'll begin with some introductory remarks, and in particular, I will distinguish between two dimensions of wisdom, which I will call the coherence and correspondence dimensions. Before addressing the possibility of collective wisdom along both of these dimensions using the theory of judgment aggregation, I'll go through some preliminary conceptual issues about the notion of wisdom and also the notion of group judgments. And so then I'm in a position to turn to the main results, first of all on the coherence challenge, and secondly on the correspondence challenge as properly defined in a moment. So let me get started. So as illustrated by this workshop, the thesis that collectives can be wiser than their individual members has recently received a lot of attention. And there has been a particular focus in the literature on collective wisdom on the capacity of groups to meet what I will call the correspondence challenge, as in correspondence with the facts. In particular, one of the central findings is that by pooling dispersed information held by the members of a group, this group can make judgments that accurately track some independent truths or make decisions that maximize an independent objective function. One of the best-known classic illustrations of this effect is Condorcet's jury theorem, to which I will come back a bit later. Basically, Condorcet observed that if each member of a jury has an independent chance, better than random, but obviously less than perfect, of making a correct judgment on the matter of guilt, then majority judgments are much more reliable than individual judgments. And as the jury size increases, the probability of a correct majority judgment approaches certainty, a very striking result. Now, meeting the correspondence challenge is obviously an important dimension of collective wisdom, but it is definitely not the only one. I think that a group's ability to come up with a coherent body of judgments also matters. So let's call this the coherence challenge. It seems that coherence of some form is a necessary condition of wisdom. Minimally, coherence would require the absence of inconsistencies in one's judgments, or at least the absence of blatant inconsistencies. More strongly, perhaps, coherence might require the satisfaction of certain closure conditions, such as closure under known inference. We can obviously distinguish between a number of coherence conditions of different strength. If you think about expert panels or multi-member courts, the types of bodies that are expected to be collectively wise, those bodies would hardly be considered wise if they did not deliver a body of judgments that satisfy at least some minimal coherence constraints. If their judgments were outright inconsistent, somehow we would consider this to be a failure of collective wisdom. Now, the aim of this paper is to discuss the lessons that we can learn about collective wisdom along both of these dimensions from the theory of judgment aggregation as distinct from the literature on Condorcet's jury theorem. Proper references to all these bodies of work are in the paper itself. There are a number of distinctions between the focus of these two bodies of literature. First of all, while the work on the Condorcet jury theorem has focused largely on the correspondence challenge, much of the recent work on judgment aggregation focuses on the coherence challenge. And secondly, while the Condorcet jury theorem and its numerous extensions are usually taken to support a largely optimistic picture of collective wisdom, the literature on judgment aggregation is replete with impossibility results. Now, I think if we look at these two, well, opposite extreme pictures, though they are not really conceptually speaking opposites, then still a fruitful approach to thinking about collective wisdom lies arguably somewhere in the middle. And I want to suggest here that insights from both bodies of theory are needed to provide a more nuanced assessment of a group's capacity to attain wisdom. Okay, so let me turn to some conceptual issues about wisdom and group judgments. So when does it make sense to describe an entity as wise? Well, we wouldn't describe rocks, sofas, or power drills as wise, for example. Human beings, on the other hand, are clearly paradigmatically capable of wisdom. Might the concept of wisdom also apply to non-human animals or perhaps to robots? So again, there seems to be no conceptual barrier in describing a complex computational system such as this computer called HAL 9000 in Arthur C. Clarke's Space Odyssey as wise. I don't have a verdict on this particular computer system, but in science fiction we can clearly dream up a system that meets these conditions. Similarly, an intelligent and experienced non-human animal, let's say the sort of senior elder in a group of primates or so, might also qualify as wise in some form or other. I mean, this, of course, depends a bit on the precise notion of wisdom that we employ. Well, what makes the concept of wisdom in principle applicable in such cases is the fact that the entities in question here are agents. So they are entities that can be understood as having cognitive and emotive states, encoding beliefs and desires, and as acting systematically on their basis. Now, here I want to interpret wisdom a little bit more weakly than perhaps in ordinary parlance, namely as a property of entities that are at the very least, proto-agents, that is, entities which have cognitive states that encode beliefs or judgments. So in particular, I will here use the concept of wisdom to refer to a proto-agent's capacity to meet the correspondence and coherence challenges defined above. Now, admittedly, this is a very thin and pragmatic interpretation of wisdom, which clearly contrasts with thicker, more demanding interpretations that would require much richer agential capacity. So the classic notion of Solomonic wisdom, for example, clearly goes well beyond this. So I do not pretend that Solomonic wisdom can be captured by truth tracking and forming coherent judgments alone. But I'll set this more demanding notion aside here. Okay, so let's ask whether groups can count as proto-agents. Well, this depends very much on how a given group is organized. We already heard earlier today that design matters. So I would suggest that a well-organized expert panel, a group of scientific collaborators, or the monetary policy committee of a central bank may very well be candidates for proto-agents, whereas a random crowd somewhere on the street of just passers-by pedestrians who happen to be at this spot is clearly not, because it lacks the required level of integration. So in particular, the group to count as a proto-agent must have the capacity to form collective beliefs or judgments, and for this it needs an organizational structure that it can use for generating them. So for example, the group may need something like either a voting procedure or a deliberation protocol or some other mechanism by which it can make joint declarations or deliver a joint report or come up with something that counts as the set of cognitive states of the group as a whole in a recognized manner. Such procedures are clearly in place in expert panels, multi-member courts, policy advisory committees, and groups of scientific collaborators. So in principle, they are candidates for proto-agents of the kind we are interested in here. Now, for the purposes of this talk here, I want to follow the literatures on both judgment aggregation and the Condorcet jury theorem in focusing on the formation of binary acceptance-rejection judgments as opposed to non-binary degrees of belief. So specifically, this means that consider groups that seek to form a collective acceptance-rejection or true-false judgments on a given set of propositions and denegations. So let's call these propositions under consideration the agenda of propositions. and the group seeks to form them on the basis of the group members' individual judgments on these propositions. Now, while the case of non-binary beliefs, degrees of belief in the form of subjective probabilities, for instance, is clearly also important, I think it's fair to say that many real-world judgmental or decision-making tasks do require the determinate acceptance or rejection of certain propositions, let's say on the guilt of a defendant or the viability of a policy. And so for this reason, I think the binary case is in any case salient and interesting, even though it's not the only important case to be considered. Okay, to formally represent the propositions on the agenda, we just use a standard propositional logic. This has the advantage that we can express not just isolated atomic propositions without any logical connectives, like P, Q, R, and so on, but we can also express compound propositions with logical connectives, stating interconnections between other propositions such as P and Q, P or Q, if P then Q, and so on. And many decision-making or judgmental tasks that, let's say, courts are faced with would involve a number of atomic propositions, but usually there is also some background constraint which tells us, for instance, that having done a particular action and also having had a legal or valid contractual obligation or so are both jointly necessary and sufficient for some other conclusion. So there is some compound proposition looming there in the background. Okay, now, how can we model the group's organizational structure? Well, this will be modeled as an aggregation procedure, which is defined as a function that assigns to each combination of the group members' individual acceptance, rejection judgments on the propositions on the agenda a corresponding set of collective judgments. So here's what an aggregation procedure looks like. It's a simple input-output scheme that takes individual judgments as input and produces collective judgments as output. The simplest or perhaps best-known example is majority voting, but there are many others. In fact, if we look at the logical space of possible aggregation procedures for a given judgmental task, this is truly vast, because the number of functions that can map a combination of even, let's say, just yes-no judgments on a single proposition into a corresponding yes-no judgment already exponentially grows in group size. So there are many possible aggregation procedures a group could employ. Now, the task ahead is to investigate what properties a group's aggregation procedure must have for the group to meet the coherence challenge, and secondly, what properties it must for the group to meet the correspondence challenge. And I want to combine insights from the theory of judgment aggregation with insights from the literature on the Condorcet jury theorem to address these two questions. So let me now turn to the coherence challenge. So let's suppose a group seeks to form collective judgments on some agenda of propositions. We have to ask whether the group can ensure the coherence of these judgments. And so I want to begin with an example to illustrate the problems at stake here. So let's consider an expert committee which has to prepare a report on the health consequences of air pollution in a big city, so for instance Paris, especially by pollution by very fine particles smaller than 10 microns in diameter. So this is an issue on which there has been considerable public debate, because these small particles are meant to be particularly dangerous for our lungs. Let's suppose that the experts have to make judgments on the following three propositions and denegations. Proposition P, the average particle pollution level exceeds 50 micrograms per cubic meter air. Proposition if P, then Q, if the average particle pollution level exceeds this amount, then residents have a significantly increased risk of lung disease compared to non-residents. Proposition Q, residents have a significantly increased risk of lung disease compared to non-residents. Clearly, these three propositions are logically interconnected. Now, as the experts may disagree, these are really tricky empirical questions, they need an aggregation procedure to resolve potential disagreements. So let's suppose as a first illustration that they use majority voting and imagine that the individual judgments R as shown in this table here. So this is a situation which we could entirely plausibly imagine. The first expert thinks that all three propositions are true. The second expert thinks that pollution is above this threshold, but doesn't think that this has anything to do with lung disease, and so this expert can rationally conclude that there is no increased risk of lung disease. The third expert thinks that there is a connection by which pollution above this threshold would lead to an increased lung disease risk, but this third expert disagrees with the empirical measurement, so again, he or she is not worried about an increased risk of lung disease. Now, if the committee were to take majority votes on these three propositions, I'm not saying that it should do so, but if it were to do this, then it would run into the following situation. A majority accepts proposition P, a majority accepts proposition if P, then Q, and yet a majority accepts the negation of Q, not Q. So the set of propositions accepted by a majority in this particular case is an inconsistent set. This problem is sometimes called the discursive dilemma. What it illustrates is that under majority voting, a group may not achieve consistent collective judgments, even when all group members hold individually consistent judgments. Moreover, I hinted at different notions of coherence of different strengths. We can observe here that the committee's judgments also violate deductive closure. Why? Well, P is accepted by a majority. If P, then Q is accepted by a majority. Proposition Q is also available on the agenda, and yet it is not accepted. So we've also got a failure of a closure, and we can assume known inference in this case. So the expert committee obviously fails to meet the coherence challenge in this particular case. But we still have to ask whether this example is just an isolated artifact or whether we can learn something more general from it. So here is a theorem which tells us something much more general than the example. So let's consider any multi-member group which has to make judgments on a set of non-trivially interconnected propositions like the ones in the example. It then turns out that there simply exists no aggregation procedure generating consistent collective judgments which satisfies four minimal conditions. And what are these four conditions? Universality, the procedure accepts as admissible input any possible combination of consistent and complete individual judgments on the propositions. Secondly, decisiveness. For each proposition, the group judges either the proposition or its negation to be true. Thirdly, systematicity. The collective judgment on each proposition depends only on the individual judgments on that proposition, and the same pattern of dependence applies across propositions. And finally, non-dictatorship. The collective judgments are not always determined by a single antecedently fixed individual. If we care about those four conditions, then we simply cannot find an aggregation procedure which generates consistent collective judgment and thereby ensures that the group will generally meet the coherence challenge. So if the four conditions were indispensable, this would immediately undermine a collective wisdom, in this case, understood along the coherence dimension. But I think this would be too quick a conclusion. In particular, the result, I think, should be seen as characterizing the logical space of possible aggregation procedures. How? Well, we can characterize different possible such procedures in terms of which of the conditions they meet and which they violate. So let's look at what the possible escape routes from this impossibility theorem are. Well, we could give up universal domain or universality by admitting as input to the aggregation procedure only those combinations of individual judgments where there is already a certain amount of cohesiveness among the individuals such that those patterns giving rise to inconsistency don't occur. Perhaps if a disagreement in a group could be limited through a period of deliberation prior to performing the aggregation, this might be an option. I think a lot could be said about this, but I think it's safe to say that under general conditions of pluralism, this is not a generally a viable escape route. A second route would be to give up the decisiveness requirement and to opt for a unanimity or supermajority rule with a sufficiently high threshold, where propositions are collectively accepted only if a sufficiently demanding supermajority of individuals is happy to accept them. And if we set the threshold high enough, then this can indeed ensure a coherence, but at the expense of very often generating no determinate judgments on proposition negation pairs at all as output. So the price for this would be stalemate.
How high?
Well, there's a formula for this. Basically, in the example, any threshold above two-thirds would work. In more complex examples, you need larger thresholds. So the threshold can be calculated as a function of the complexity of the interconnections between the propositions. I can say more on this later. A third route, which I think is generally perhaps the most plausible one, is to relax the systematicity condition by not treating all the propositions in exactly the same manner in arriving at collective judgments, but by, for instance, prioritizing some propositions over others. Specifically, two aggregation procedures have received a lot of attention in the literature. The premise-based procedure, on the one hand, involves the idea of assigning priority to certain propositions that are designated as premises, then taking a majority vote only on those premise propositions where they have to be selected so that they are logically independent from each other, and then deriving the collective judgments from those premise votes on all other propositions. And this is indeed attractive in many cases and has some interesting properties also with regard to the correspondence challenge. I hope I still have time to come to this.
You have 9 minutes.
Yep. Good, excellent. This is sometimes contrasted with something else called the conclusion-based procedure, where the group singles out just those propositions that it needs to resolve or make judgments on for narrow pragmatic purposes, call those the conclusion propositions. So this could be a liability issue in the case of the court, setting aside all the reasons for liability that are there in the background. And then again, the group might take majority votes only on those pragmatically specified conclusion propositions and on nothing else. So here we abandon not just the systematicity requirement, but also the decisiveness requirement, because the group just delivers no judgments on a large number of propositions at all. Finally, there is, of course, the possibility of giving up non-dictatorship and opting for the degenerate case of no genuine aggregation, where the collective judgments are just the judgments of some antecedently fixed dictator or chairperson. But this is obviously not interesting in the context of collective wisdom. Okay, so aggregation procedures clearly matter insofar as different aggregation procedures not only differ with respect to whether or not they guarantee coherence at the collective level, but they also differ with respect to the judgments they produce. And without going through the details here, I've basically just applied a whole range of a whole number of different aggregation procedures that I briefly mentioned to these judgments in the example that I've given you of the expert panel. And it turns out, in this example, it's constructed in the right way, that all these different aggregation procedures fundamentally disagree. So no two of these procedures really deliver exactly the same body of collective judgments. So groups can really have fundamentally different collective outputs depending on which procedure they opt for. So if we want to assess a group's claim to wisdom solely in terms of the coherence challenge, then this is still insufficient for selecting a unique aggregation procedure. So let's turn to the correspondence challenge and let's ask whether this can help us to constrain the class of admissible or good or attractive aggregation procedures a bit further. And I suppose I'll have to be relatively quick here. So let's ask whether a group can ensure the correspondence of its judgments with the relevant facts. Well, what do we mean by correspondence? The strict definition would say that an agent's judgment on a given factual proposition P corresponds with the facts, just in case the agent judges that P if and only if P is true. Now, real-world agents are, of course, fallible and meet this correspondence requirement at best approximately. So we therefore need to quantify how well an agent does. And we do this by calculating what we call the agent's positive and negative reliability on P. The positive reliability of the agent is the conditional probability that the agent judges that P, given that P is true. And the negative reliability is the conditional probability that the agent does not judge that P, given that P is false. And doing well at the correspondence challenge would require that the group achieves a high positive and negative reliability on the propositions that are brought to it for adjudication. Now, the simplest case we could consider would be making a group judgment just on one single factual proposition, and this is the case which is covered by Condorcet's classic jury theorem. So if Condorcet's competence and independence assumptions are met, then majority voting does a great job here. So we might say in this special case there may be epistemic gains from majoritarian democratization. This is familiar material. So let's look at the scenario in which we want to form judgments on an agenda of logically connected propositions, because those were the cases that gave rise to the concerns in the theory of judgment aggregation. Now, here some tricky problems arise, because individuals cannot generally have the same reliability on all these different propositions because of the constraints between them. So, for example, if individuals have a reliability of R, let's say 0.6, on proposition P, and independently a reliability of also 0.6 on if P then Q, then this could be combined to a composite reliability on only 0.6 squared, which is 0.36, on proposition R. So what this means is when there are multiple logically connected propositions, Condorcet's competence assumption is not necessarily met on all of them, even if individuals are quite reliable on some of these propositions. And the conclusion-based procedure in such a scenario could really suffer from this, insofar as when it comes to judging that P is true, given that Q, the overall conclusion about the risk of lung disease in the example, that this is true, given that it is actually true, the group's reliability gets smaller and smaller and smaller as the group size increases. The group's negative reliability would be quite good. So if the air pollution is safe, the committee will find out if the committee is large enough. But if there is a risk of lung disease from air pollution, the committee won't find out. By contrast, the beneficial effects of Condorcetian information pooling can be fully harvested by the premise-based procedure here if we make sure that majority votes are taken precisely on those propositions on which individuals are most competent in Condorcet's original sense, and we designate those as the premises, and then derive collective judgments on everything else from these premise judgments, then we can do well in terms of the positive and negative reliability of the group, even on those judgments on which a straight majority voting wouldn't do a good job. And so here I've calculated the group's positive and negative reliability under the premise-based procedure in exactly the same example. And, you know, if you contrast this with the earlier picture of the conclusion-based procedure, you can clearly see that the premise-based procedure outperforms it. So let me come to some concluding remarks. A lot more could be said here, so I've really picked just some illustrative results that lie really in the intersection of the theory of judgment aggregation and Condorcet's jury theorem. So I've looked at two dimensions of wisdom, wisdom as coherence and wisdom as correspondence, admittedly both very thin pragmatic interpretations of wisdom. And with respect to both of these dimensions, I've asked under what conditions a group can attain wisdom in each of these senses. And with respect to the coherence challenge, I think the impossibility results of judgment aggregation are quite useful in characterizing the logical space of possible aggregation procedures in terms of which of the various conditions they meet and which of the conditions they violate. And this can then allow us to come up with some good case-by-case criteria for selecting plausible or attractive aggregation procedures for certain groups, certain judgmental tasks, and certain contexts in question. This still, I've suggested, does not always help us to select a unique best aggregation procedure. But once we take the correspondence challenge into consideration as well and ask, you know, which of the remaining, you know, nicely axiomatically characterized aggregation procedures also guarantee a good truth-tracking reliability by the group, then we can narrow down the possibilities further. And basically, there are not just benefits from democratization, as classically shown by the Condorcet jury theorem, but there are also often benefits from decomposing judgmental tasks by not taking votes on broad conclusions, but by instead looking at a number of different, perhaps logically equivalent premises in support of those conclusions, and then taking votes on those alone. Now, overall, these results paint a fairly optimistic picture of collective wisdom, contrary to the negative picture that the impossibility results on judgment aggregation or social choice theory more broadly may seem to suggest at first sight. Now, admittedly, the details of this optimistic picture depend on many favorable conditions, so I've deliberately set aside all the complexities and problems that can arise. But nonetheless, I think that possibility results like the ones I've shown you here can be illuminating, and I also hope that they illustrate the usefulness of the present theoretical approach in identifying those conditions that promote collective wisdom and those that undermine it. Thank you very much.
I also, he draws on these, relates his work to sort of insights from these two literatures, neither of which I'm very familiar with, but they seem very relevant, very interesting. So one is the theory of judgment aggregation, and another is this work on Condorcet's jury theorem. And his paper explores lessons about collective wisdom from these two literatures. So we've just heard from Scott Page, obviously, another perspective on lessons, if you like, micro foundations for collective wisdom. So it's interesting to think about the parallels between these two papers. But let's just talk briefly first about things that are particular to List's approach. So he finds that he suggests that collective wisdom requires at least, I think that. It's right in saying this is a sort of minimal, you put this forward as a minimal requirement for collective wisdom, as a correspondence in the sense that the group judgment really needs to sort of reflect the underlying facts of the matter, and a coherence, the group judgment has to be logically coherent, otherwise, as Christian said, you know, the group could, the judgment couldn't really be considered wise. And he considers a group that's been charged with the matter of forming a binary sort of acceptance, do you accept or reject this agenda, these propositions that together comprise this agenda. And it could be that they are non-trivially interconnected, as they were in some of the examples that Christian gave in this presentation. And he considers three seemingly reasonable conditions. This isn't quite the way he presented it, but it's a little bit more in line with the paper that I was reading this morning, and obviously logically consistent with that. He specifies three seemingly reasonable conditions that an aggregation procedure should satisfy. So the first is universality, or the universal domain. And Christian's already explained what this is, but the aggregation procedure has to admit any input, as input, any possible combination of consistent and complete individual judgments. Decisiveness, the aggregation procedure generates as output complete judgments on the propositions in the agenda. And systematicity, the collective judgment on each proposition in the agenda should depend only on individuals' judgments on this, and the pattern of dependence should be the same across propositions. And Christian goes on to explain that a whole host of aggregation procedures could satisfy these conditions. However, if we also want these if we want both these conditions to be satisfied, but also the collective judgment to be guaranteed to be consistent, logically coherent, then only degenerative dictatorial procedures that really aren't in keeping with the spirit of collective wisdom under consideration at this workshop are possible. And so this is problematic, but Christian sees this as an opportunity to sort of explore the logical space for feasible collective wisdom. And so he overturns, he suggests that this result can be overturned by relaxing one or more of these conditions, and he considers, you know, which are the more favourable candidates among these these conditions. And I won't repeat him there. But let's just move on. What about correspondence? So Christian says that a lot of the emphasis in the collective wisdom sort of literature and discussion has been sort of heavily focused on correspondence. So how closely does the group judgment tally with the facts of the situation? And so you might think of correspondence as sort of low probability of errors, and indeed I think that's sort of the approach you're taking. You're talking about sort of positive reliability of individuals and negative reliability, and there's a sense in which you can, you know, very straightforwardly think of these as type 1 and type 2 errors from a statistical perspective. And you didn't really discuss this today, but in the paper you talk about the possible benefits of democratization, decomposition, decomposing the problem, decentralizing when you want to make sure that you're going to achieve an organizational design that can promote collective wisdom in this fuller sense. And so an overall conclusion from Christian's work seems to be that you're unlikely to find a one-size-fits-all aggregation procedure that dominates. And I would say, so from a game theoretic perspective, there's a sense in which the Christian's thrust is guided by a search for strict dominance. So he's looking for something that you'd always want to choose because it's better, both in the sense of coherence and correspondence. And I'll come back to that point when I reflect slightly on his paper. But he basically says there's a sense in which you're not going to find this one, you're unlikely to find one-size-fits-all solutions, but there's optimism for collective wisdom. There are things that, you know, you could imagine being relaxed in the real world relative to this sort of stark theoretical benchmark, and you might well achieve collective wisdom. So a few personal reflections on the paper, again, in no particular order. I think it's interesting that you stress a focus on these two dimensions of collective wisdom. I think that's a welcome addition to the literature. And out of that, you provide us with a new perspective on the conditions for the crowd to be wise in this twin sense. And Scott Page, in his paper that he presented today, in the paper itself, he argues for wanting in the future to have a crowd of models of collective wisdom, very much in the spirit of, you know, these sort of diverse predictive models. And so I think this is obviously a very interesting contribution to a crowd of models that we might seek to establish for collective wisdom. But of course it's important and interesting, I think, to try to relate the work that Christian's done and the sort of conditions that his work is throwing up to insights elsewhere in the literature. In particular, I'm thinking today, because I've spoken on this paper, about Scott Page and his co-authors' work on the micro foundations of collective wisdom. And so just, you know, top of the head reflection, but I'm sure you can see many more parallels. This Condorcet's jury theorem, you might think about these competence and independence conditions as having an analogue in the sort of literature that Scott's been contributing to, and you might think about expertise and diversity instead and these sorts of things. And you might, you know, I'm sure you could go through both papers and start to try to map interesting sort of analogues there. And the paper touches upon a rationale for deliberation. You didn't really touch very much on that today, I don't think, but you talk about a pre-aggregation deliberative process by which you hope to achieve some harmonisation of individual positions, and that might make it easier to achieve meaningful collective wisdom in some settings. I think it's interesting that your model does throw up this sort of suggestion of heterogeneity and not a one-size-fits-all approach, and that seems to tally very well with what we see in reality. So I want to come on now to what for me was perhaps one of the most interesting insights from your paper. Thinking about your discussion about positive reliability and negative reliability now, so how close does the judgment accord with the underlying facts of the matter? You know, from a statistical perspective, you might think about false positives, false negatives, it's the same thing. And I think it's interesting, you actually say that literature and the discourse focus too much on correspondence. I don't think it's focused, I think it should also focus on other things, but it also hasn't focused enough on a full version of correspondence, because we focus very narrowly, for instance, in the prediction markets literature, on average accuracy. Well, you may not give a damn about average accuracy, right? You may really, you know, dread the idea of a type 1 error. And that's really it for you, you know. So I think it's important to step back with all of these considerations and think, where to the information aggregation? What are we using the information for? you know, as a society or a principal in a principal agent sort of setting, and what is the what's the objective of this exercise, and you know, maybe you want to spell out some sort of loss function where the loss function depends on type 1, type 2 error instances. And indeed, that's some work that I've been doing back in Oxford with my colleagues Ian Jewett and Claire Lever. We've been trying to sort of take a more statistical decision theoretic approach to comparing the performance of information aggregation mechanisms. And we've been thinking a little bit about a decision maker who ultimately will come to depend on the information generated and perhaps has a loss function, cares in some way not to be sort of perhaps understood as the same way in each model on these type 1 and type 2 errors. And you could broaden that consideration and get into issues of delay. You know, how long is it going to take to throw up a decision? You know, maybe you want to do a quick poll versus a prediction market and so on. So that would be a broader consideration of what really matters to the ultimate decision maker.
Yeah, just very briefly. Well, thank you very much for these wonderful and very clear comments. So I can take everything on board that you've said, and I'll be very brief in the interest of time. So I entirely agree with what you say about looking at type 1 and type 2 errors and sometimes asymmetrically trying to avoid one or the other depending on the costs of these two types of errors. And it's precisely because I want to keep the distinction between false positives and false negatives in the model and in the picture here that I've not focused on average competence or average reliability of the group, which is something that is very often done in the literature on the Condorcet-Drury theorem. And just to give one illustration of why average reliability really doesn't capture truth tracking or correspondence in a good sense at all, imagine a diagnostic test for a very rare disease, which happens only a handful of times in a population of millions. Now, if this diagnostic test always says negative, regardless of the condition of the patient, it has it's got a fantastically high average reliability. And yet, as a truth tracker, this test is completely useless. So, that's just one example of why we need to distinguish between
that's
these.
Right. You see a lot of emphasis on these calibration tests, of prediction markets and so on. So this is the sort of thing I have in mind when I talk, if it's not already clear, when I talk about average accuracy.
Okay, yeah, I'll leave it there. So thank you very much again.
One is just a puzzle. It's called Scott writes in his book about how if you keep fundamental preferences constant, then aggregating into policy preferences really amounts to aggregating instrumental beliefs. So in that perspective, at least some forms of belief aggregation are simply special case or errors problem. So is that clear? That's my first question. Is it clear?
Okay. I see this question. And certainly you could say that if preference heterogeneity stems solely from belief heterogeneity, yes, what preference aggregation boils down to is a particular instance of belief aggregation. As far as
the Aerobian conditions should apply
to this particular problem. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I mean, let me because the question of how the results in judgment aggregation relate to Arrow's theorem, for example, gets raised quite a lot. And I mean, there's one thing that I'd like to mention on this. Mathematically speaking, one can actually prove Arrow's theorem as a corollary of some of the theorems on judgment aggregation, whereas the converse derivation has not been done, and it actually by now seems that there is no straightforward converse derivation. And the reason why one can derive Arrow's theorem from these results on judgment aggregation is quite simply the following. One can express a preference relation as a binary relation, which can be encoded in predicate logic in the form of judgments or the acceptance of propositions of the form X is preferable to Y, Y is preferable to Z, Z is preferable to and so on. And then you can map Arrow's framework entirely into the propositional framework, and one can then show that some of the conditions of results along these lines, not the one that I've shown you here, but something closely related, would precisely coincide with Arrow's conditions under this particular embedding.
My second question refers to cases in which premise-based aggregation and conclusion-based aggregation give different results, but premises are both fundamental preferences and instrumental beliefs. So suppose that you have three groups, two of which agree on their fundamental preferences, two of which, not the same, agree on their instrumental beliefs. Then you can show, I can do it on a blackboard, that it could be the case if you aggregate first the individual policy preferences, then you get one result. If you aggregate first individual preferences, then individual instrumental beliefs, and implement the policy preferences that according to the aggregate preferences is the best given the aggregate beliefs, you get the opposite result. Is this a general...
That's absolutely right. In fact, the mixed aggregation problem, where some of the attitudes that are being aggregated have a preferential interpretation and others have a belief interpretation, is sometimes studied under the label the Bayesian preference aggregation problem. And the discrepancy between these two approaches that you sketched is sometimes referred to as the discrepancy between the ex post and the ex ante aggregation approach. And ex post and ex ante basically refers to the order in which you aggregate beliefs and preferences.
And there's a normative answer to what is best?
No, I think is the answer to your question. And the reason is quite simply that if you impose minimal conditions along the lines of the present conditions here on the aggregation function, then, as soon as you are not even any more demanding than Arrow was, you're going to run into a massive impossibility theorem. And so then it depends on which of these conditions you are willing to give up and which of the conditions you insist on keeping. And there doesn't seem to be a general answer to this question.
Well, for an academic to issue a word sentence that contains the word no, That's wonderful. It goes to Professor Sperber.
Can you make sure the mic is on?
It's not on.
It's on.
No,
it's on.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Wow, it's too much on. Okay. The problem you describe at a collective level occurs also at the individual level. It was actually a main point of the book that Daniel was quoting today of Gil Harman, Change in View. That is, I may believe P, I may be given good reason to believe if P then Q, but I may also have good reason not to believe Q, and therefore have to choose which to reject of these three propositions. So you could do that collectively by seeing which has fewer votes. Of course, in the example you gave, it was a tie. But it wasn't a tie because of Cohen's problem. You could have ties for atomic proposition if you have an equal number of people say true and people say false. So there's one way at least of handling the problem, which is by dropping the proposition which has the least number of votes. Any comment?
Yeah, I mean, yes, this is one aggregation procedure that you can certainly construct, and it would also fall into the rubric of giving up systematicity, because you would not drop any of the majority judgments in those cases where there are no logical inconsistencies, but in those cases where there are logical inconsistencies, you'd presumably start revising majority, or you'd start revising judgments depending on how many votes they've received. And so that may lead you to handle the same propositions differently under the same pattern of individual judgments in different cases. So it would fall under the rubric of giving up systematicity. I mean, I do think that this is overall the most promising way to avoid the problem. And in practice, I think most real-world decision-making bodies do give up systematicity. But the price we have to pay for this, and I didn't get to talk about this here, is that one key part of the systematicity requirement, namely the independent consideration of each proposition, turns out to be a necessary condition for strategy proofness. which is the invulnerability of the aggregation procedure to strategic manipulation. And so if we, so in fact, one can show that non-manipulability in the context of judgment aggregation is logically equivalent to the conjunction of independence and another condition called monotonicity. And so if we throw out systematicity, you know, thereby throwing out independence, we open the door to strategic manipulation. And then this raises, you know, complicated questions of whether or not this is a big deal from a real-world perspective.
Thank you.
Professor Andler.
Thank you. There's a theorem from formal learning theory, which might be familiar or not. I don't know what's happened to the field, by Oschersen and Weinstein, which says that you can avoid the arrow impossibility theorem if you restrict the preferences to those which are learnable, essentially transmittable from, say, parents or peers to the children, to the newcomers. And so I have two questions about this. First of all, is there anything of the same sort that, you know, might be developed in your framework? And second, don't you think that this is exactly the sort of result that we would like, because it's sort of motivated from a cognitive point of view?
Yes. So this particular way to avoid Arrow's theorem in the you know, classic preference aggregation context, basically, no, I've the mic here, corresponds to giving up what I call universality here. So we introduce a domain restriction on the admissible inputs, and we can do so in a number of different ways, so as to ensure the consistency of the majority judgments. And indeed, I mean, well, my colleagues and I have looked at domain restrictions in the case of judgment aggregation as well, and it turns out that the judgments of all the individuals in a group can be rationalized in terms of a single underlying cognitive dimension in a way that I could explain in more technical detail, then we get something somewhat analogous to the median voter theorem in preference aggregation theory, namely basically the judgments of the median individual on that particular cognitive dimension would always have majority support, and then so long as the median individual is internally consistent, we can also ensure the consistency of majority judgments. So the answer is yes, one can identify some structure conditions on combinations of judgments across individuals such that if those structure conditions are met, then majority voting is always consistent, and then, of course, all the other minimal conditions can be met as well. And some of those structure conditions have a nice semantic interpretation, for instance, in terms of some kind of shared cognitive conceptualization of the issues. Others are harder to rationalize. But I think this is somewhat in the same spirit as Oschersen's work.
Professor Esling.
Yeah, I have a question about what's the value of meeting the coherence challenge. So suppose the whole literature and sort of interest in this area had just been labeled collective accuracy, and the book was called Collective Accuracy, and we titled our papers Collective Accuracy. What would we be losing? That is, one way of putting this is, would we ever trade off accuracy or correspondence, as you call it, to get more coherence in the group? Suppose I have a panel of doctors. I want to know, you know, what I should do to treat my illness. Would I trade off any accuracy for coherence? Or democratically, we want to know what policies we should enact. And we have a very accurate, you know, method, but we could get a little less accurate one, but it would be coherent. And what would be the value of that?
Right. So, well, you're asking a very difficult philosophical question. I mean, ultimately, this is the question about why coherence of our systems of beliefs or judgments matters. And, you know, I do understand that people can be divided over this. I mean, I've always assumed that there are some major problems if we, at least in the capacity of, you know, being an agent, endorse a body of judgments which is inconsistent. So, for example, from an inconsistent set of propositions, anything follows. So, assuming you don't have a paraconsistent logic, then you've got this standard inference rule, ex falso quod libet. So anything is a logical consequence of an inconsistent body of judgments. And so that in itself could be a problem. I mean, imagine, for instance, that a body like the Supreme Court runs into play. I mean, perhaps it does. I mean, I'm not a scholar of this area, but if a body of judgments issued by the Supreme Court runs into inconsistencies which are all too blatant, we obviously have a problem and it can be challenged.
One follow-up.
Just can you say what the problem is in the case of the Supreme Court? Suppose it's the most accurate, you know, it's the most accurate mechanism. I'm granting, for the sake of argument, that coherence matters in individuals. I don't know how to explain exactly why, but there's lots of desiderata for individuals, tact, and you know, all kinds of things that we wouldn't apply to collectives. So this is a bunch of individuals. Why does it matter that their things act like they were an individual?
Well, I mean, for a start, if you've got an inconsistent set of propositions, then we know for sure that not all of them can be simultaneously true. So there is a very minimal sense in which inconsistency is incompatible with accuracy. Moreover, the body of implications of those judgments is no longer of any practical guidance. And so you might say that insofar as policy recommendations often lie within the deductive closure of the judgments that are produced by the expert advisory panel, we would immediately have an inconsistent body of recommendations. But, I mean, what I certainly am happy to concede is that inconsistencies can be of different levels of blatancy, if you like. And one direction in which I've gone in some of the technical work is to introduce formal measures of the blatancy of inconsistency. So, for instance, if you accept a proposition which is a contradiction by itself, let's say P and not P, that's the most blatant inconsistency. Call this an inconsistency of degree one. If you accept P here in your beliefs and you accept not P over there, that's still pretty blatant. So that's an inconsistency of degree two. If you accept something like P, Q, but also not P and Q, that's still pretty blatant, but it's an inconsistency of degree three. So generally, an inconsistency of degree k would be a set of k propositions which together are inconsistent, but such that any subset of k minus one propositions are consistent. And I think empirically it's quite fair to think that, you know, all of us are inconsistent, from a certain level k onwards. But what we typically strive to do in our, let's say, theoretical endeavors in philosophy, science, law, wherever, is to, if you like, sort of push up the k. And so you might think that, you know, what collective wisdom perhaps requires is to at least avoid inconsistencies of these really blatant kinds.
Professor Genry.
Thank you. Just two comments from an outsider. First point, you said that the coherence problem was different from Condorcet jury's problem. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it may relate to another point made by Condorcet, which is the Condorcet paradox.
Absolutely.
Which
yes.
We understand better now because it's called Arrow's theorem. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this brings me to my second point, which relates with your question. Yeah. My first guess was that your theorem was a consequence of Arrow's theorem. Let me explain why. It's because if you call object in the theory of social science a string of proposition, okay? If you call your preferred proposition the ones you believe true, after that you put as second type of proposition that are equivalence, the one in which something is wrong, and after that those in which two things are wrong, and so on, you have an individual preordering on the object, okay? That's and it seems that you are very close to the standard framework of social choice theory, an extended framework. So, but you told me that Arrow's theorem was a consequence of your theorem. So the question is, maybe they are equivalent.
Well, I remain open to the possibility, but basically, so far, no one has really been able to derive Arrow's theorem as a corollary of... No, sorry. No one has been able to derive these theorems here as a corollary of Arrow's theorem. And a number of people have tried along also lines of this kind. So I remain skeptical, but open. But the converse derivation is really quite a straightforward one.
Helene Landemore will ask the last question, and then we all get to go outside after we thank the speakers.
So I'll make it short. It's a question about the value of coherence as well. So I know you use this term in a somewhat technical sense, as a discrepancy between the premise-based conclusion and the conclusion-based judgments. And I'm just wondering how stress on coherence matches or fits with the importance of cognitive diversity, because it seems that one key element for reaching correspondence or accuracy was cognitive diversity, which seems to require some degree of incoherence maybe in the perspectives or heuristics or predictive models used. And I know I'm sure there's a good answer to this question, but it doesn't come to my mind very directly. So if you could explain how those two things are compatible, coherence and cognitive diversity.
Coherence and cognitive diversity. I would think that cognitive diversity in relation to groups is largely a property of the group members, or either the combination of judgments across group members or the judgment formation process among the individuals. Whereas coherence, as I've investigated here, would be a requirement imposed on whatever the aggregation procedure produces as its output. So the judgments of different individuals can still be very fundamentally at odds with each other, and yet we want to integrate them in such a way as to arrive at an overall coherent report. I mean, think about something like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is this massive expert panel which has had a lot of press coverage recently following the Nobel Peace Prize. And they consist of literally hundreds of collaborating and contributing scientists across the world and policymakers and so on, with widely different perspectives. And yet, what they seek to achieve, I mean, I'm not in a position to judge whether they succeed, but what they attempt to achieve is to come up with an overall report which satisfies the sort of standard scientific requirements of coherence across the judgments that they pronounce.
Thank you.
Okay, let's thank Professor List and Professor Croxon for our comments.
Thank you.